Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail, stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell. Chapter 11, Sagebrush Justice. The Sink of the Humboldt is a lake of strong, brackish water, where the river empties into the natural basin formed by the slant of the surrounding district of mountains, plain and desert, and where some of the water sinks into the ground and much of it evaporates, there being no surface outlet. In the latter part of the summer, the water is at a very low stage, and stronger in mineral constituents. There we found the daytime heat most intense. The land that is exposed by the receding water during the hottest period of the fall season becomes a dry, crackling waste of encrusted slime, curling up in the fierce sunshine and readily crushed underfoot like frozen snow. The yellowish-white scales reflect the sunlight, producing a painful effect on the eyes. Not many feet wander to this forbidding sea of desolation. At the border of this desert lake, a few feet higher than the water, is a plateau of sand covered with sagebrush and stones. We were there in the last week of August. Fresh water was not to be had, except at a place a half mile from our camp, where there was a seepage spring. There we filled our canteens and buckets with enough for supper and breakfast. The animals had to endure the night without water. Not far from the spring was situated a rude shack, known as Black's Trading Post. This establishment was constructed of scraps of rough lumber, sticks, stones, and cowhides. With Mr. Black were two men said to be his helpers. Helpers in what did not appear. The principal stock in trade was a barrel of whiskey, reported to be of very bad quality, some plug tobacco, and not much else. Black's prices were high. A sip from the barrel cost 50 cents. It was said to be an antidote for alkali poisoning. Some of our men visited this emporium of the desert, and there they found Jim Tooley. The barrel had been tapped on his behalf, and he was loquacious, appearing to be quite at home about the post. His two companions of our recent acquaintance were not there. The antidote was working. Tooley was in good spirits and eloquent. He did not appear to recognize those of our people who were visiting the place, but they knew him. There were other persons present from the camps of two or three companies of emigrants, but strangers to us, who were also stopping for the night at the margin of the sink. Tooley assumed an air of comradeship toward all, addressing various individuals as partner and neighbor, but his obvious willingness to hold the center of the stage made it clear that he deemed himself the important personage of the community. Some things he said were self-incriminating. He boasted of having done up a lot of pikers up the creek, declaring his intention to look up another lot of suckers the following day. When our men thought that they had heard enough, they returned to camp and reported. Recollections of the last time we had seen Mr. Tooley made the present occasion seem opportune. An impromptu court was organized, judge, sheriff, and deputies, and those with a few chosen men of the company went to the trading post to convene an afternoon session. The members of this court dropped in quietly, one or two at a time, looked over the place, asked questions about the country, the price of Mr. Black's goods, how far it might be to Sacramento, anything to be sociable. But none offered to tap the barrel. The stranger emigrants had heard of the Indian raids up the river, seeming to have inferred something of pending events. They had gone to the trading post in considerable numbers. Tooley was still there, Black and his two men seemed to be persons who ordinarily would be classed as honest. Still, they appeared to listen to Tooley's tales of prowess and of the looting of immigrant trains, as if they regarded such proceedings as acts of exceptional valor, exhibiting as much interest in the recital as did the tenderfoot immigrants, who held a different opinion regarding those adventures. When enough had been heard to warrant the finding of an indictment, the newly appointed judge issued a verbal order of arrest, and the sheriff and his deputies quickly surrounded the accused before he suspected anything inimical to his personal welfare. With revolver in hand, the sheriff commanded, "Hands up, Jim Tooley!" To the astonishment of all, the big man raised both hands without protest. This, however, in mock obedience, as was evident by his laughing at the supposed fun. "This is not a joke, sir," came in harsh tones from the judge. "When we saw you last, about 16 days ago, you came to our camp to deny a charge made against you by a man of our company. You overawed, browbeat, and insulted the man and those who were assisting and protecting him in his distress. You denied the accusation made against you with vehemence and much profanity. Giving you the benefit of the doubt, we permitted you to go. Now we are here to take the full statement of the prosecuting witness and examine such other evidence as there may be. We will clear you if we can, or find you guilty if we must." In whatever direction the culprit looked, he gazed into the open end of a gun or pistol. The sheriff said, "Now, Tooley, any motion of resistance will cost you your life." A disinterested onlooker at the moment would have cringed, lest the unaccustomed duty of some deputy should so unnerve his hand that he would, inadvertently and prematurely, pull the trigger of his weapon, but all held sufficiently steady as they looked through the sights. The prisoner slowly grasped the situation and knew that temporary safety lay in obedience. The sheriff's demand for Tooley's weapons created more surprise when it was revealed that in his feeling of security while at the post, he had relieved himself of those encumbering articles and deposited them with the landlord, that he might have freedom from their weight while enjoying the hospitality of the place. Thus his captors had him, as a tiger with teeth and claws drawn. His weapons, when brought out from the hut for examination, were found to be two pistols of the largest size and most dangerous appearance in a leathern holster, the latter made to carry on the pommel of a saddle in front of the rider. These, also his saddle and other trappings, were searched for evidence. But except the pistols, nothing was found that tended to throw any further light on the question of his guilt or innocence. Tooley was then taken under a heavy guard to a spot some distance from the post, where the court reconvened for the purpose of completing the trial. His captors had, with good reason, reckoned Tooley as like a beast of the jungle who, when put at bay, would resort to desperate fighting, but having been caught thus unawares and unarmed, violence on his part or resistance of any kind was useless. He was doubtless feigning meekness, hoping for an opportunity to escape. A jury was selected mostly from the stranger emigrants. The improvised court sat on an alkali flat near the margin of the lake, where there were some large stones and clumps of sagebrush. There Tooley was confronted by Mr. Wood, still with bandaged arm. Tooley declared he'd never before seen the Englishman, but Wood said he had seen Tooley, and now reaffirmed his belief that the prisoner was one of the persons whom some weeks previously had ridden with the Indians who killed Mrs. Wood and the child, also wounded and robbed the witness. Still, the evidence was not deemed sufficiently positive or complete, the identity being in some doubt. The jury would not convict without conclusive proof. With the view of procuring further evidence, the judge ordered that the person of the prisoner be searched. Hearing this mandate, Tooley first made some sign of an intention to resist, only a slight start, as if possibly contemplating an effort to break through the cordon of untrained guards. "Gentlemen," ordered the sheriff, "keep every man his eye on this fellow and his finger on the trigger." Then to the prisoner, "Stand, sir, or you will be reduced to the condition of a good Indian." Escape as yet appeared impossible, and Tooley must have finally come to a definite realization that he was in the hands of men who meant business most earnestly. Bravado had ceased to figure in his conduct. It was apparent that the search for evidence was narrowing its field. The erstwhile minions of frontier justice were on the right scent. Tooley grew pallid of feature, and his cheeks hollowed perceptibly in a moment. There was a wild glare in his eyes as they turned from side to side. Fear, hatred, viciousness mingled in every glance. He crouched, not designedly, but as if an involuntary action of the muscles drew him together. His fists were clenched, his mouth partly opened, as if he would speak, but could not. Thus he stood half erect, while the officer searched his clothing. The examination disclosed that secured in a buckskin belt, worn under his outer garments, there was English gold coin, to the value of $500, just 1/3 of the amount that Mr. Wood declared he had lost at the time of the robbery. What became of the other 2/3 of Mr. Wood's money was readily inferred, but full proof of it was not necessary to this case. Tooley's trial was closed. The only instruction the court gave the jury was, "Gentlemen, have you heard the testimony and seen the evidence? What is your verdict?" The answer came as the voice of one man. "Guilty." During the entire proceeding, at the post and down by the lake, the judge sat astride his mule. Addressing the prisoner once more from his elevated bench, he said, "Mr. Tooley, you are found guilty of the murder of Mrs. Wood and her child, the wounding of Mr. Wood, and robbery of his wagon. Mr. Wood has, from the first, stated his belief that you were with and the leader of the band of Indians which attacked his party. You afterwards denied it, but now, in addition to his almost positive identification and many circumstances pointing to your guilt, you are found with the fruits of that robbery on your person. Have you anything to say?" Tooley was ashy pale and speechless. Absolute silence reigned for a time, as the court awaited the prisoner's reply. If by any means he could offer some explanation, some possible extenuating circumstance that might affect the judgment to be pronounced, none came, and the judge continued, "You can have your choice, to be shot or hanged to the uplifted tongue of a wagon. Which do you choose?" Tooley took the risk of immediate death in seeking one last desperate chance for life. Instantly he turned half around, crouched for a spring, and seemingly by one single leap, went nearly past the rock pile so that it partly covered his retreat. Quick as his movements were, they were not swifter than those of the men whose duty was to prevent his escape. "Stop, Tooley!" shouted the judge, sitting astride his mule, as his long right arm went out to a level, aiming his big Colt's revolver at the fleeing man. "Shoot, boys!" commanded the sheriff at the same instant. A chorus of shots sounded, and the court's sentence was executed. Complying with the request of the judge, the sheriff had a hole dug near where the body lay, and the dead man was buried, sans ceremony. The court returned to the trading post and requested the proprietor to state what he knew of Tooley. Mr. Black declared that he only knew that the accused plainsman came to the post that day, that he bought and drank a considerable quantity of whiskey and offered to treat several passing immigrants, all of whom declined. The English gold found upon the prisoner was returned to Mr. Wood, and the incident was closed. The trial had been as orderly and impartial as the proceedings in any court established by constitutional authority. All those concerned in it realized that they were performing a duty of grave importance. There was nothing of vindictiveness, nothing of rashness. It was without due process, and it was swift, a proceeding without the delays commonly due to technicalities observed in a legal tribunal. But it was justice conscientiously administered, without law, an action necessary under the circumstances. Its justification was fully equal to that of similar services performed by the Vigilante Committee in San Francisco within a year preceding. It was a matter the necessity of which was deplorable, but the execution of which was imposed upon those who were on the spot and uncovered the convincing facts. Join me next time for more Western Adventure in Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell, here on the Sagebrush Trail.